Production team for tonight's newscast is John Salem, James Kemp, Daniel Eisner, and Dan Raphael. The producer is Dave Johnson, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. A special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira and Brian Bull. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, and on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Daniel Eisner.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Hannah Francis. I have here with me Grace Mongali to talk about her new article, Evolving Images, Guided by an Internal Compass. Standards for photojournalists covering homelessness are evolving. Guidance comes from experience, mentorship, and a personal code of ethics. Hi, Grace. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, let's talk about this article. It's great. It's kind of about ethics in photography, specifically around homelessness. You talked to a lot of different people for this article, like 9 really notable people. First, can you just tell me what made you pick this topic?
Yeah, I think partially I was kind of originally trained as a photojournalist, and when I got this internship, I anticipated doing kind of a lot more photo. And so I eventually kind of realized that just wasn't really the model of Street Roots, was to have a ton of photos to accompany stories. And so I kind of started just looking into that and looking into the ethics of it. I think as a journalist, like, I'm kind of constantly thinking about how I can make my work more ethical. And I think that there's just a very, like, unspoken norm that comes with photojournalism ethics, and, you know, lines blur. And so I just really wanted to just learn more about it. And obviously I had the opportunity to talk to, like, so many people about it, and it made me really, like, hopeful, which is kind of hard to say about journalism these days.
Yeah, no kidding. That's great. So, like you said, 9 really prominent journalists are participating in this conversation around photographing unhoused people. So can you just give me, like, some of the common threads of the conversations that you had?
Yeah, I think that what was really delightful to hear throughout my conversations where photojournalists and journalists do think about ethics, and they do develop with the times. I think, you know, some of the journalists that are still working today that I talked to graduated journalism school, you know, 20 years ago, and to understand that they see a difference and a distinction from back then to now is really great to hear. I think also, like, learning that a lot of people have learned through making mistakes or through, you know, not knowing what to do at the time. And, like, other photojournalists are already having this discourse amongst themselves. And I just really wanted to use this article to spell that out.
So let's talk about, like, some of the legal guidelines to photographing people, specifically in-house people, and how those are different from moral guidelines.
Yeah, totally. So as it states in the article, and as is kind of a common, again, like, unspoken but spoken norm in journalism, is it is legal to photograph anything on public property. It's technically, you know, kind and nice to ask people permission, ask people their names. But there's no law barring journalists from taking photos of anything that can be seen from public property, and that is in public. And so knowing that, I think that a lot of news stations and TV news kind of can latch on to things that, you know, are kind of unfounded or interesting to look at, as opposed to things that really visually tell a story. And so I think as, you know, practicing photojournalists and more people become photojournalists and more people become photographers, as Emily Fitzgerald said, the invention of digital photography and specifically iPhones, like, really, like, anyone can take pictures of anything at any time. And people are constantly doing that. So those moral guidelines are often really personally motivated. And it's really nice to see how a lot of journalists are kind of aligning those moral guidelines in the same way that they operate, quoting people and doing other kind of ethical reporting.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I really appreciated too what Robert said about people experiencing dehydration and malnutrition, and like that if he can get a person some food or water, then he can more accurately represent their thoughts or personality. Mm-hmm. I think that makes so much sense, and it's a very different way of seeing it than I've seen represented in journalism. So could you talk a little bit about how this thought process is different than past norms?
Yeah, I think it's like a very standard journalistic norm. And I think it even says so in the Society of Professional Journalists code of ethics, is to not incentivize sources. However, and I don't want to be too general here, but I think we've all said really weird things or incorrect things when we're really hungry or thirsty, because like your body literally can't process information in the same way it does when it's fed and at a normal temperature and hydrated. So I think that there's kind of like this idea of informed consent, which is where people are giving consent, but they also know what they're giving consent for. And, you know, people who are vulnerable because they don't have adequate nutrition. I think that that was part of Davis's code and some of the journalists that he worked with. Like, that's not informed consent. That's not an accurate representation if someone isn't kind of like at a baseline. And so I think it's really important to understand that, you know, we're not like seeing people as totally isolated figures in journalism, which again is something that it has been the norm historically. I think that, you know, we're trying to get to the most accurate story. So is someone going to tell you a more accurate story when they're, you know, fed and sober and like hydrated, or are they going to tell you like the most accurate story when they're just kind of like passing you on the street? So I think it also comes down to building relationships and building trust. And it's not a huge burden for journalists to spend that extra time or go that extra mile to, you know, provide bottles of water and bags of chips when they're talking to homeless people.
Absolutely. Chris Peach says in your article that he had a problem with quote-unquote parachuting in. So can you explain what parachuting in means and what the issue with that is? Yeah. And also what he's doing to address that.
Yeah, totally. I feel like this is something that a lot of journalists deal with really early on in their career when they're still trying to develop their identity as journalists and their beats. Like, they're just trying to kind of see what works. And Chris's story was really inspirational to me because, first of all, he started in 1988, which, not to come at Chris like that, but that was kind of a long time ago. And, you know, I think that that was still when we were kind of developing, you know, modern news was developing an idea of the systemicness of homelessness. And so what he expressed to me was he got called down to, you know, take photographs of homelessness, kind of when, you know, his editor wanted that, when there happened to be a story on it. And for him, it started happening more and more during his career, which eventually led him to create a beat, a homelessness beat for the Register Guard. And that's so important, especially in Eugene. It has the highest per capita homelessness rate in the country. And so treating that as a beat and thus treating homelessness as a systemic issue that he can kind of understand all of the background information for and just, you know, treat or cover the breaking news and cover, you know, discrepancies in the system or solutions to the system, I think really made it so that he was more of a fixture of that community, that people trusted him. And it made it so that there was just like a mutual trust between the community and Chris. And I think that that's just a model that a lot of journalists should emulate, is the idea that, you know, homelessness is a systemic issue, and it's important to cover kind of the long-term changes, the long-term effects, and that means going back to the same people a lot of times and seeing, you know, how they feel over the course of time. And yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about the homelessness reporting guide?
Yeah, for sure. So I talked to Robert Davis, who was part of the initial kind of collective of journalists who put together this really standardized guide of how to cover homelessness, both in terms of reporting, writing, interviewing, and photographing. And so it really seems like a collective effort. And it's something like the Journalist's Code of Ethics, which a lot of journalists, I know, especially in journalism school, that's stressed to me really heavily. It just kind of narrows that down a little bit more and makes it a little bit more explicit when talking about covering homelessness. And, you know, especially for street papers, like that is what we cover and we try to bring light to, and we try to, you know, get perspectives of people who have experienced homelessness. And it really is just kind of a guide that people can refer back to. And it has very explicit language. It has, you know, kind of like steps that journalists ought to kind of check off as they're going down the list. And I think it's like a skill that a lot of journalists, similarly to how they, you know, transcribe interviews and pick out quotations, they can kind of follow that as well. And so it was just released earlier this year. And it's an ongoing collective. There are ongoing guides being met and written. And I know they're open to new membership and want more journalists a part of the conversation. And so I was actually super optimistic to learn about it. And I think everyone should check it out.
Amazing. Thanks. Yeah. I also really appreciated what Giles Klassen of the Denver Voice had to say about reporting on the people affected by the policy and not just the policy, which I think is so basic. But it's not really built into our norms. So could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, totally. I was talking to one of my colleagues about this earlier. I feel like it's so easy to kind of regurgitate information that is released via press release or, you know, broadcasted. And while that is important and people ought to have information, they also ought to have kind of a contextualization of that information. And so those interviews, especially with people that are affected by policy, I think everyone can relate to this in some extent. Like if you're part of a bracket that gets really heavily taxed, like I want to hear, you know, how that influenced your life. And I think that that's something that people deal with every day. And it's the same thing for homeless people. They deal with the policy every day. They deal with not being able to have any sort of permanent home, because they're not allowed to camp for multiple days or multiple nights. And I think that it just ultimately humanizes it. And I think that just journalists ought to step back a little bit from their stories and say, you know, am I reporting about the policy or am I reporting about the person? And I think, like, depending on your goal, I know at Street Roots, our goal is to contextualize information. Really, I think that those interviews are really, really helpful, and also just can make it so that people who aren't directly affected maybe understand how they fit in.
Yeah. There's another point about how volunteers and politicians are photographed in a more humanizing way than homeless people. And I wonder if you could paint me a little picture about that.
Yeah, totally. I think it's a lot easier for journalists to go up to, you know, volunteers or politicians or people who have houses than it is for them to go up to people who don't have houses. Because there's just, I mean, obviously there's a stigma around it. It can be kind of stressful and intimidating, and I want to acknowledge that. But when you're writing a story about homelessness, like, I think, like, really think about who is being affected and bringing names to faces. I want to, like, call on one of the captions for the story was said by an individual named Tina who's a vendor for Street Roots. And she said, like, homeless people become fixtures of culture. And so I think, like, really take a second and think about, like, when you pass homeless people, are you making eye contact? Are you saying hello? Are you, like, doing the same thing that you would do when you pass your neighbor? Or are you treating it like, treating them like a tree or a bike or something that's just, like, not in your peripheral vision, not really something that you're focusing on? And I think that sort of attitude really influences how people think and thus influences voting, thus influences policy, thus influences people in power, thus influences how we're going to actually find a solution to this issue. And so when we're talking about that, I think that people who don't have houses just ought to be treated the same way as people who do or notable figures, by simply asking their name or simply photographing their face as opposed to their belongings or their hands. I don't think you would often see a photo of the mayor's hands. You would see a photo of his face. Yeah.
Well said. Yeah. The homeless population is growing a lot. It has been for a long time. And it's kind of just like you're saying, crucial that we recognize and be intentional about how we're covering this population. How do you think that this knowledge can inform people's coverage of people living outside?
Yeah, I think that it was really well said by a couple of studies that I read, and the first photographer I talked to, J.M. Simpson, which is in the very beginning of the story. And I think that there will be, people, and there are people, honestly, who are denying the severity of this issue. And journalism and photojournalism and photography itself is such an impactful medium in kind of distilling a sense of time and, like, a time that we were in to, like, what actually happened. And so I think that coverage about homelessness, like, ought to be widespread. And I think it also ought to be solutions focused because, again, kind of back to that issue of homelessness becoming a fixture and not a crisis and an inhumane, crisis that we're dealing with, especially here in Portland. And so, like, it makes me really optimistic that there are journalists already having discourse about this. But it also, makes me a little bit worried that we're focusing a little bit too much on the sensationalization of it and not the solutions of it. So with this, and with these practices, I just hope that we turn further and further to finding a solution and using the media to, again, influence opinions, influence voting, influence policy, influence those in power, and thus find a solution to this issue. Yeah.
Anything else you want
I had a great time writing this article, and I'm so grateful to every, professional who really took some time to, like, introspectively think about their practices and be able to regurgitate it to me. And so, yeah.
Nice. Yeah, it's amazing. So many very interesting people. I really appreciated learning what they had to say. Where can people find this article?
This will be on the cover of Street Roots coming out on tomorrow, July 29th.
It's the 30th, I think, for
30th.
tomorrow.
And it will also be up on our website and on our social media, so check that out as well.
Sweet. Thank you so much, Grace. So good
Yeah,
to
thank you,
talk with
Hannah, for
you.
having me.
You've been listening to an interview with Grace Mungali, the Snowden Street Roots intern. I'm Hannah Francis.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The peace deal between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, brokered by the Trump administration, seemed to offer some hope for the DRC after 3 decades of war. A new policy brief from the Oakland Institute argues that rather than creating a lasting peace for the Congolese people, the agreement will instead benefit corporate and financial interests anxious to gain access to the country's wealth. Andy Currier is a policy analyst with the Oakland Institute. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with him about the agreement between Rwanda and the DRC, the recently announced ceasefire between the DRC and the Rwanda-backed M23 militia, and who would really benefit from the peace deal.
Democratic Republic of the Congo and Rwanda, they've got some sort of agreement, and I guess this relates to the agreement between M23 and the DRC, right? Could you explain how that works? M23 and Congo forces have been fighting for a long time now, and M23 backed heavily by Rwanda. Some say it's really just Rwanda. Anyway, could you talk about what's going on there and what this peace, what would you call it, a ceasefire or a peace agreement means for these two countries?
Yeah, so there was a first peace agreement that was signed in late June, and that was between Rwanda and the DRC, and this was brokered by the Trump administration. And the agreement, the ceasefire you're talking about, was between M23 and DRC. As you mentioned, Rwanda, it's been extensively documented by the UN that Rwanda's been supporting M23 for years. So what was really curious was the first agreement in late June between Rwanda and the DRC. M23 was largely absent from that, despite the central role that they play in the conflict.
So what was going on there? Was Rwanda trying to hide the fact that, even though it was obvious that they were supporting M23?
You'll hear in interviews with officials that they're still very much publicly in denial about that, despite all the evidence, which has made, you know, these agreements difficult. It's a big reason why Congolese civil society was so much against the peace agreement between Rwanda and the DRC from June, really talking about how it was rewarding Rwanda for its aggression through the support to M23 and really to greenlight the continued looting of natural resources in the DRC.
So who's really going to benefit from this agreement?
Yeah, and it's a good question. You know, unfortunately, after over 30 years of really horrific violence and suffering on civilian populations, it does not appear that the Congolese population is set to benefit. There's a lot of doubts that the peace agreement will hold. But recently, the Oakland Institute published a policy brief that looked into some of the Western financial interests who have been linked to the deal, linked to benefit. When it was announced, Trump even said, you know, the U.S. was getting lots of minerals from the Congo as a part of the deal, which is not, you know, something you typically see in peace agreements between two different countries, but it's really a minerals for security deal. So some of these interests include major mining companies with troubling track records like Rio Tinto, Ivanhoe, Orion. They've been reportedly negotiating in light of the deal. There's also the first actual deal, because there is a lot of speculation. The first actual deal has been signed since the peace agreement was reached, and that's between DRC and Cobalt, which is actually a Berkeley-based AI mining firm, which is backed by an extensive list of billionaire investors, among them Gates, Bezos, Sam Altman from ChatGPT, and Mark Anderson. And another really big part of this is how many of these firms are really closely tied to President Trump and his own associates coming into cash in on these deals.
Well, wasn't that Trump's motivation to do a deal with Ukraine?
There are some similarities there as well. In this context, you know, you are just seeing kind of the, it's not what America is going to get, it's what President Trump and his associates, people who have given money to his campaign. In DRC, for instance, one of the groups is called America First Global. It's run by the finance co-chair of Trump's 26th campaign, this guy Gentry Beach, who's a close friend of Donald Trump Jr. He's now negotiating for access to a major mine in DRC. You also see Eric Prince, an infamous mercenary, has signed a deal to assist with DRC to assist with taxation and reducing smuggling of minerals, which has really raised concerns that a lot of the only peace this deal is going to bring is some security to mining sites and not to actual communities.
So what kind of relationships do these companies or some of these billionaires have with the governments involved, if any?
Yeah, so a lot of them, and this is all detailed in the brief, but you have several billionaires behind these firms who have been donors to Trump's inauguration. You have Mark Anderson, who's involved through Cobalt. He was a member of of the Department of Government Efficiency, which I'm sure you guys have covered all the havoc they've caused. You also have Elon Musk involved through Tesla. They supply lithium from the DRC. So you've got a lot of people close to President Trump who are really coming to benefit here. It's under the guise of critical minerals and securing critical minerals for the United States, given China's role currently as the largest mining power in the DRC. But ultimately, you're seeing Trump really taking care of his own, you know, either donors or close associates, and it's not really going to benefit the broader American public.
And you mentioned cobalt and lithium. Any other minerals involved?
Yeah, lithium is a big one. So DRC actually is estimated its total mineral reserves are worth $24 trillion. So it's got 70% of the world's cobalt, also large reserves of copper, coltan, gold, all critical for military technology, smartphones, electric car batteries, and more.
And what does Rwanda get out of this deal in terms of mining interests?
Yeah, that's really something that remains to be seen. So a lot of minerals are smuggled out of DRC and into Rwanda. This has been also documented by the United Nations in several reports, but Rwanda reports exporting much higher amounts than they're actually able to mine in their own country. So a lot of these are being smuggled. One of the fears with the deal here is that it's going to kind of legitimize this smuggling and exportation to Rwanda, given that DRC doesn't have the capacity to process a lot of these minerals currently, and the deal makes no, you know, mention of developing that down the road.
What about surrounding countries? Are they being affected at all? Neighboring countries?
Yeah, so Uganda's involved as well. They've played a role in the conflict in the last 30 years. It's a very kind of complex situation, but you've seen the external forces really have a big influence on what's been happening in the DRC. And some of the concern from civil society is, you know, there's all these players who are, you know, pushing their agendas on what's happening with DRC's minerals, but absent from these peace agreements are actual civil society and people in the DRC to put in a new system where they can actually start to benefit from their own mineral wealth, which, you know, a quick look at the history of the country will show that for hundreds of years, this has not been the case.
What about Africa as a whole? Are there organizations involved? The organization, what is it called, of African Unity, or any regional military forces?
Yes. Yeah, so the African Union is part, along with the U.S. And Qatar, of kind of an oversight to oversee any disputes between the two countries that might arise. One of the critiques of this deal is that it's very vague on what actual, you know, military commitments these other countries are making here. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of talk of the DRC having to disarm the FDLR, which is another group operating in DRC fighting Rwanda and M23. But the focus is all on that and not on Rwanda's role in the violence, which has been seen as a really kind of one-sided part of the agreement.
And what about the people who work in the mines? Is there a human rights issue there? Workers' rights?
Yes, certainly. And so one of the things in the last, you know, couple of months since M23's offensive really took off, you've had several large mines actually shipped from control from the DRC government to M23 and essentially Rwanda, from what the UN has documented. And what this is really, you know, there's been kind of change in ownership, but what's stayed one constant is the poor conditions for laborers on these mines. And so that's something that unfortunately does not appear set to change. There's talk when the deal was initially signed from Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, that, you know, we're going to be bringing in these U.S. firms who are good corporate citizens and really, really change how things are done. But as the Oakland Institute's brief takes a close look at, a lot of these firms abhorrent track records in terms of labor rights, in terms of environmental damages, in terms of financial crimes. So it's something that we're just kind of raising, you know, that's not like the American companies are going to show up and everything is going to change for the actual miners.
What is that called? The Sullivan rules, or you know what I mean? The idea that certain rules and regulations have to be followed or else business can't proceed?
I'm not exactly sure, but I think just overall that it's one of these things that there can be a lot of talk about how things are going to change and how there's going to be all these standards and safeguards around mining. We've seen the World Bank has a sustainable mining initiative, which really ultimately, yeah, they can put these safeguards in place. They could make nice presentations. But when you look at what's actually happening with projects that are being funded on the ground, unfortunately, there's really serious limitations to traceability of a lot of these minerals. And so a lot of it is really public relations and not actual improvements for miners.
Any hope that things will change? That's what your institute is doing, and others, other human rights activists are doing.
Yeah, you know, I think the fact that this deal has gotten a lot of public scrutiny is a positive step. It's not just seen as a peace agreement. It's the kind of official line from the Trump administration that this is going to lead to peace and everyone's going to profit equitably is, I think, pretty widely debunked. Of course, there still can be more pressure put on by local Congolese groups for their own government to take a better deal. But given some issues with democracy, we've seen that that's been sort of an issue. So we don't do too much prediction. We're not as much in the prediction business, but we'll definitely keep a close eye on it, including subsequent agreements that are being signed, like you mentioned, between M23 and the government, to see the terms of those and really dig into who would benefit.
Anything you want to add?
No, I would just encourage anyone who wants to learn more to take a look at the brief. It goes into far more detail than I can do off the top of my head. Really, it's very, I think, a really critical area. You hear so much about transition minerals as needed to address climate change. I think there's a lot of underlying, you know, actual underlying importances about the military industrial complex and how critical they are in those technologies. So it's something to keep an eye on. And it's not sort of like there's labor violations, but these minerals are needed to fight climate change. It's certainly not that simple.
That's Andy Currier of the Oakland Institute speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Daniel Eisner.
Hi, this is Mark Sanford Gross from KGUA FM, Walla, California. When I'm in Portland, which is often, I listen to KBOO, KBOO, 90.7 on your FM dial.
Here goes nothing.